And I'm back to read Hitler's War by David Irving. Hitler's word is law. The first half of 1942 was again to bring the Soviet Union to the brink of defeat. The German soldiers' self-confidence had been restored. With the Führer's prodding, they had mastered the terrors of the Russian winter, where even a Napoleon had failed. At the end of February, the foreign diplomats in Berlin were informed that the Führer had now decided to fight to the bitter end. Initially, as Hitler's secretary vividly described, the mood at his headquarters upon his return from Berlin was bleak. Quote, "After 2 days of warmer weather, the temperature suddenly dropped again," she wrote on February 27, 1942. "The chief is always dog-tired, but he won't go to bed, and this is often a torment for the rest of us. We used to play records most evenings, but then you could fall back on your own thoughts. But since Tut's unfortunate end, the music evenings have been few and far between. And as his tea circle always consists of the same faces, there is no stimulus from the outside, and nobody has any personal experiences to relate, so the conversation is often tedious and indifferent, to say the least. There is also a Scotch terrier, but he is not all that popular, as he is obstinate and capricious. Besides which, the chief says he looks like a scrubbing brush, and he'd never let himself be photographed with it." End quote. Hitler's health had suffered from the winter. but he allowed himself no respite. In December, he had jibed to Halder, quote, "You fine generals only play ball so long as everything's going well. The moment the going gets tough, you report sick or tender your resignations," end quote. He ordered a string of arrests. On March 8th, his army adjutant Engel notified the Reichsfuhrer SS, quote, "The Führer has ordained that Reich Railroad Oberrat, senior counselor, Landenberger and Counselor Hahn are to be taken into custody forthwith. Both officials are charged with serious incompetence in the positions they held during the Eastern Campaign, in parentheses, as the responsible directors of Army Railroad Directorates Center and South." Morrell added an ever-increasing variety of medicines to the Führer's medicine chest. Despite all his endeavors, visitors to Rastenburg that spring found Hitler gray, drawn, and ailing. He confided to Goebbels that he suffered attacks of giddiness. Quote, "The Führer describes to me," wrote Goebbels of a conversation on March 19th, "how close we were these past few months to a Napoleonic winter. Most of the blame for this is Brauchitsch's. The Führer has only words of contempt for him. A vain, cowardly wretch, unable to even grasp what was happening, much less master it. By his constant interference and disobedience, he completely wrecked the entire plan of campaign in the East, which had been devised in crystal clarity by the Führer. The Führer had no intention whatever of aiming for Moscow. He wanted to cut off the Caucasus from the rest of Russia, thus hitting the Soviet system at its most vulnerable point. But Brauchitsch and his general staff knew better. Brauchitsch kept hammering on about Moscow. He wanted prestige victories instead of real ones." End quote. For the coming German offensive in the East, Hitler had again established a clear list of priorities. This time, General Halder accepted them, as Hitler set them out in conference on March 28, 1942. The main summer offensive, Blue, would open with the capture of Voronezh on the Don. Then the armies would roll southeastward down the Don towards Stalingrad, digging in along the river for winter quarters. By early September, he hoped they would have reached the Caucasus Mountains. Depending on the summer victories, he would decide later what operations to undertake in the center and against Leningrad. After the defeat of Stalin's main armies, Hitler planned to construct an immense east wall beyond which there might well rage a 100 years' war against the scattered remnants of the Bolshevik forces. Quote, "Russia will then be to us what India is to the British," he told Goebbels. End quote. Already, the Soviet Union had lost the iron ore of Krivoy Rog and the manganese of Nikopol. The armor plate of their latest tanks was consequently of poor quality, but if Blue succeeded, Stalin would have no coking coal or oil. Or, does it say coking? Yeah, it does say coking coal or oil either. When the naval staff persisted in arguing for the capture of Rommel by the Suez Canal, Halder impatiently replied, quote, "The Caucasus operation is still absolutely vital for our oil supply position," end quote. He held that only victory in the Caucasus would ensure the Reich's ultimate survival in the war. Halder's words were quoted by his naval liaison officer in a document in German Admiralty archives. After the war, he and departmental heads like General Adolf Heusinger claimed to have been unanimous in opposing the Caucasus campaign. The British aided Russia by intensifying the war in the air in March 1942. On the night of March 3rd, RAF planes dropped over 450 tons of bombs on a Paris arms factory, killing 800 French civilians. Hitler ordered the Luftwaffe to execute an immediate reprisal on a British target, but a few days later he canceled the order, explaining to Jeschenik that he wanted to avoid provoking air raids on German cities. Besides, the Luftwaffe was incapable of meting out appropriate annihilation raids on English cities. A week later, a force of 200 RAF bombers, laden primarily with incendiaries, all but destroyed the medieval Baltic town of Lübeck, leaving 320 dead in the ruins. This time, Hitler did order reprisal attacks on English towns, to be chosen for their defenselessness and cultural value, the same criteria as Churchill had applied. London was explicitly embargoed from attack. It was an unedifying sight. The two opposing leaders, well bunkered in their respective capitals, trading blows at each other's innocent citizenry. How Stalin, who had long learned to think in terms of centuries, must have relished it. The British had no alternative as yet. However, Hitler's intuitive sense of strategy warned him late in March that the Cherbourg and Brest peninsulas might be the target of an Allied invasion. On March 27th, he ordered all available reserves immediately moved to the region of West Caen and Saint-Nazaire, and he gave instructions that the U-boat base at Saint-Nazaire itself was to be closely reinforced. The very next morning, the British launched a commando raid on the base. The aging destroyer Campbelltown, accompanied by torpedo boats and motor launches laden with commandos, entered the base before dawn, rammed the locked gates of the huge dry dock, and was abandoned. French dockyard workers and sightseers were still clustered curiously around her at 11:45 a.m., when her hidden cargo of time-fused explosives blew up, killing 60 of them. Over 140 British prisoners had been taken. The interrogation reports submitted to Hitler showed them to be the cream of Churchill's forces. Most of them no longer believed Britain could win, but felt that the war would just fizzle out. Goebbels' English language propaganda was said by these prisoners to have a big listening public. Quote, "We all like the Germans," said one British mayor. "It's just that we're certain that Hitler is planning to conquer the world," end quote. Told that Hitler had no designs on Britain at all, the mayor is said to have exclaimed, quote, "Then why not tell our government and people that? I would be willing to go to the British government and tell them what your peace terms are, and I give my word of honor to return to captivity here. But for God's sake, do it now before the hundreds of thousands who will die on both sides in this summer's fighting are sacrificed," end quote. Hitler was now 53. On his birthday, there were letters from Eva Braun and her mother, and from his sisters Angela and Paula. He wrote back, sending them ham he had just received from a Spanish admirer, with a warning to them to cook it thoroughly before eating. Raeder, Goering, Milch, and Ribbentrop, and a host of lesser dignitaries attended the birthday luncheon held in a dining room decked out with tablecloths and flowers. The headquarters officers and staff were given a glass of Peace Porter, Gold Tropfen, and cups of real coffee. After lunch, the real birthday treat, the first two Tiger tanks, were demonstrated to Hitler. In the east, the roads and fields were drying out. The snow had vanished almost everywhere.
Never in his life had he yearned so painfully for the onset of spring. He never wanted to see snow again. It had cost him 6 months, 6 months of these, his precious last years. The strenuous bunker life in East Prussia had sapped his strength. The first white hairs were appearing on his head. Since Hitler's doctors prescribed the solitude of the Berghof, he asked Ribbentrop to arrange an early meeting with Mussolini. Hitler's train left the Wolf's Lair on April 24th on the first leg of the long journey to Bavaria. It was followed by Ribbentrop's equally impressive train. Quote, "A wonder that the foreign minister allows anybody to take precedence over him," joked Hitler. In Berlin, he was to address the Reichstag, asking for powers that would neutralize the meddling lawyers of the Ministry of Justice for all time. He showed the necessary decree to Hans Lammers 4 hours before the speech began on April 26th. Lammers suggested that it would suffice for the Reichstag to pass the law by acclamation. Goering would follow Hitler's speech with a formal approval of the law as president of the Reichstag. The Reichstag records show Hitler thundering, quote, "I do, however, expect one thing, that the nation give me the right to take immediate action in any way I see fit, wherever I do not find obedience unconditionally called for by service of a greater cause. This is a matter of life and death to us." And there's loud applause. At the front and at home, in transport, civil service, and the judiciary, there must be obedience to only one idea, namely the fight for victory. Let nobody now preach about his well-earned rights. Let each man clearly understand from now on there are only duties. End quote. At 4:24 p.m., the session ended. The last time the Reichstag would ever meet Adolf Hitler... The last time the Reichstag would ever meet. Adolf Hitler was himself the law. In the first meeting with Mussolini at Klesheim, near Salzburg, Hitler painted the German position in Russia in optimistic terms. He promised that in 1943, the Ukrainian harvest would yield at least 7 million tons. Both agreed that a watchful eye was needed on France. But at the other end of the Mediterranean, Turkey was slowly but surely edging around to the Axis camp, if only in consequence of her hatred of the Russians. There was ample proof of this. Turkey had recently imposed a crippling fine on the British envoy in Bulgaria, whose luggage had mysteriously and undiplomatically blown up in an Istanbul hotel. The second meeting between the dictators was up at the Berghof. The Italians pressed their case for an early capture of Malta. Hitler viewed the operation with distaste, not only because it was to be a primarily Italian operation, and hence in his eyes predestined to ignominious failure, but because he still argued that the war could only be won in the East. The Mediterranean theater was a sideshow of value only for tying down enemy forces. In deference to the alliance, Hitler paid lip service to the needs of Hercules. Since April 2nd, German and Italian bomber forces had been mercilessly softening up Malta for invasion. In mid-April, he had also agreed to supply German parachute troops for the eventual assault provided the British did not, in the meanwhile, spring surprises on him in Norway or France. He wanted Rommel's offensive in North Africa to begin before the British could start theirs. Given the limited Axis air strength in the Mediterranean, Hercules would have to be postponed at least until after that. Early in May, therefore, the OKW laid down that Rommel should launch his offensive at the end of the month, with Hercules postponed until mid-July or mid-August. The actual objectives of Rommel's offensive were themselves a matter of disagreement. The Italians wanted him to halt on a line between Sollum and the Halfaya Pass, but Hitler wanted Egypt. A Finnish report had claimed that 90% of the Egyptian population was anti-British, so it must be ripe for revolution, in Hitler's view. Hitler's intake of information was phenomenal, but this was a necessity if the Führer principle was to be maintained. Ambassador Huell had logged over 1,100 different diplomatic papers passing through his hands to Hitler in 1941. By early April 1942, he had already submitted over 800 more. Now, as commander-in-chief of the army, Hitler assumed a workload that would have crushed many men. We shall probably never know all the intelligence data on which Hitler based his decisions. A few weeks earlier, his post office had begun listening in on the enemy's scrambled radio telephone link between London and Washington. A regular flow of transcripts had reached Hitler through Himmler ever since March 1942. The transcripts included the top-secret conversations between Roosevelt and Churchill. Unfortunately, these transcripts later vanished, either during or after the war. Decoded confidential Turkish and Yugoslav dispatches from the Soviet capital enabled Hitler to follow Stalin's guesswork over Germany's coming offensive. Hitler's intent was to feign preparations for a renewed offensive against Moscow. The decoded American telegrams from Cairo to Washington were even better. In February, the Italians deciphered one in which Washington inquired about the possibility of invading Northwest Africa. At the end of April, Cairo was heard advising Washington of the crucial position in Malta. Anti-aircraft ammunition was running out, and there was no gasoline for the motor transport. Other American messages betrayed the strength and dispositions of the forces opposing Rommel. From more orthodox diplomatic sources, Hitler heard the first rumors of an amphibious invasion of France by Admiral Mountbatten's forces. Probably one of the more damaging items was the confirmation blurted out by Churchill, who evidently forgot the wartime slogan, "Walls have ears," that the mounting ship losses were bringing Britain to the, quote, "brink of her most critical moment since the war broke out," end quote. This quotation reached Hitler through Spain and encouraged him to step up his U-boat and Luftwaffe offensive on the Atlantic and Arctic convoys. In the last week of May, convoy PQ-16 to North Russia was attacked. 7 ships were sunk, with 32,400 tons of war supplies, including 147 tanks, 77 aircraft, and 770 motor vehicles. Every Allied vessel sunk reduced the threat of a second front. During May 1942, Hitler's armies regained the military initiative in the east. Only the growing menace of the partisans fighting in the rear of Kluge's Army Group Center gave cause for concern. In the eyes of many Germans, a great opportunity had been lost, that of winning at least the traditionally anti-Soviet Ukrainians to their cause. This had been Reichenau's last message to Hitler before he died in January 1942. It was the advice of Goebbels and particularly of Rosenberg as well. Rosenberg bitterly told Hitler on May 8th that with greater tact, the Russian workers could have been procured voluntarily by rounding them up like slaves. Sokol, as Hitler's manpower dictator, was merely driving hordes of Russians before him into the forests, thus supplying new recruits for the partisan armies. Gauleiter Erich Koch, the Reich Commissar of the Ukraine, was even worse than Sokol and quite out of Rosenberg's control. Quote, "I know that we always used to say the Slav liked a good whipping," said Rosenberg, but he went on to complain that some Germans in the Ukraine were taking this literally and strutting around with a whip in hand. This was a bitter blow to the Ukrainians' self-esteem. Hitler welcomed the idea of using Russian prisoners themselves to help fight the partisans, but nobody, certainly not Rosenberg, could persuade him to appoint at least puppet Russian governments in the conquered regions. The general staff suggested that Hitler allow the use of poison gas to combat the partisans, thereby countering illegal warfare with illegal weapons. Hitler would not hear of it. Similarly, he forbade the general staff to study the problems of biological warfare, except in a purely defensive light. What may have been a hangover from his own gassing experience in the First World War kept him adamant to the end. Although the British, illegally, employed phosphorus in their bombs, Hitler forbade its use in the Luftwaffe's, as its fumes, too, were poisonous. Since German scientists had developed nerve gases, sarin and tabin, to a degree of sophistication unknown to the enemy, his otherwise inexplicable inhibitions were not without effect on the war effort. In mid-April, Hitler summoned Colonel Lehosen, Canaris's chief of Abwehr, subversive and sabotage operations, to discuss German partisan operations. The Russian prisoners who had volunteered for these proved surprisingly effective, filtering in their own uniforms or plain clothes through Russian lines to execute clandestine missions against their former comrades. Furnished with the necessary passwords, they were able to return through the German lines unscathed. Army Group South, and particularly the 17th Army, had high praise for them. During April, single pairs of Abwehr agents had already parachuted into Voronezh, Stalingrad, and Krasnodar to sabotage key railway lines, power stations, and pipeline installations. Special task forces had also been trained, one to defend the Maykop oil fields, another to cut the railway line from Moscow through Rostov to Baku, and third to organize an uprising in Georgia. The biggest force was the Bergmann Battalion, 200 German-language experts and 550 re-educated Russian prisoners from the North Caucasus and Caucasia. When the hour struck, their task would be to infiltrate into the Caucasus Mountains to clear and hold key passes and to arm the anti-Soviet sections of the population. These were operations in which neither Germans nor Russians could expect any mercy if captured. Armed with overwhelming air superiority, the German spring offensives were opened by General von Manstein's 11th Army in the Crimea on May 8, 1942. By May 15th, some 170,000 Russians were his prisoners. The remaining Soviet forces in the area were dead or had committed themselves on rafts to the Black Sea. The second offensive, Fridericus, was scheduled to begin on the 18th, with Kleist's Armagruppe and the 6th Army pinching off the Izium salient east of Kharkov. But the Russians launched a spoiling attack first, throwing an unprecedented weight of tanks into the salient on the 12th in a drive for Kharkov. By evening, they were less than 15 miles from the town. Field Marshal von Bock telephoned Halder that evening that Fridericus would have to be abandoned in favor of a frontal defense of Kharkov, but the Chief of General Staff replied that Hitler thought differently. Bock warned, quote, "This is no blemish. It's a matter of life and death," end quote. He saw their only salvation in withdrawing 3 or 4 of the infantry and armored divisions to stall the Russian onslaught south of Kharkov. He telephoned this suggestion to General Halder urgently on May 14th, the most crucial day of the battle. Hitler would not hear of it. On the contrary, he ordered that Fridericus was to commence as planned to the south. He telephoned Bock himself, explaining to the harassed field marshal that at a time like this, a counterattack was the very best solution possible. To ensure that there was no misunderstanding, Hitler ordered Halder to confirm the instructions to Bock's army group in writing. For 2 days, there was crisis. Hitler insisted that his generals keep their nerve. By the 22nd, Kleist had linked up with the 6th Army and encircled the enemy. Within the next week, 239,000 prisoners and over 1,240 captured or destroyed tanks were counted on the bloody battlefield, and Hitler had regained the Donets River. Hitler's ebullient mood during this victorious battle emerges from the diary of Richthofen, who lunched with him on May 21st. Quote, "At lunch he held forth to our immense amusement with an endless flood of easy arguments as to the special privileges of smokers. For example, the right to drive off mosquitoes from all non-smokers, and on the idiocy of winter sports, on hunting and the raising of deer in order to shoot them, on deer themselves as foodstuffs, after they've eaten 5 times their own weight in foodstuffs first, and on trophy hunting. Why don't soldiers mount the jawbones of dead Russians in the rooms then?" And so on. End quote. Victor of the Battle of Kharkov, Hitler returned briefly to Berlin. He told Goebbels on the 29th that the grand objective of Blue would be the Caucasus. Then we'll strangle the Soviet system at its Adam's apple, so to speak. End quote. Halder persistently assured him that Stalin's reserves were drying up. Rumors that Stalin was mobilizing a reserve of over 100 divisions beyond the Urals for the coming winter not to be tapped even if Moscow itself was endangered, were discounted. More than once in private, Hitler commended Stalin's harsh leadership, for this alone had saved the Red Army from extinction. Quote, "If we cannot emulate their toughness and ruthlessness," he said, "we might as well give up the fight." He drew comparisons between a beleaguered garrison which had just withstood a Russian siege of 4 months and the American troops who surrendered the fortress of Corregidor in the Philippines, even though they still had food for another 2 months. Thought-provoking though the captured Russian newsreels of the nightmare battle for Moscow were, with the abandoned German tanks, guns, and trucks heaped black against the snow and thousands of ill-clad, hungry German prisoners being herded away to an uncertain fate, it was the faces of these unknown, unsung soldiers that gave Hitler hope, for he was convinced that they betrayed no trace of fear or personal surrender. The cloak and dagger of war agents and assassins was by no means confined to the East. By May 1942, Allied Secret Service activity in Norway was increasing. Joseph Terboven, Reich Commissar for Norway, was summoned to confer with Hitler, and Himmler reported the results to Heydrich soon after. On the 27th, Heydrich was mortally wounded as he drove into Prague in his open Mercedes. The underlying purpose was to set Europe ablaze by provoking Nazi countermeasures against the indigenous Czech population. In revenge for Heydrich's death, the Germans liquidated Lidice, the village found, or Lidice, maybe, the village found to have been, to have harbored the Czech-born assassins. Undoubtedly, according to SS General Karl Wolff, it was the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich that inspired Himmler to attack the Jewish problem with renewed urgency. Eyewitnesses have described the traumatic effect on the Reichsfuhrer. He appeared for dinner that day with Hitler ashen-faced and barely able to speak. Since a Jewish Congress meeting in Moscow had, according to Goebbels' diary, just broadcast directives to world Jewry to launch a war of assassination, the Nazis assumed that Heydrich was the first victim. Quote, "Assassinations can set a bad example if we don't act ruthlessly against them," wrote Goebbels. He ordered the arrest of 500 Berlin Jews as hostages. As he put it in a telling turn of phrase, there were still 40,000 Jews at large in Berlin with, quote, "nothing more to lose," end quote. The fate of many of the deportees was evidently swift and final. The archives of the Berlin Revenue Authorities reveal that the Gestapo wrote them just 10 days after one swoop on May 27th, enclosing a list of those who have since died and the assets they had declared before being deported. Dr. Goebbels again pleaded with Hitler over lunch on May 29th to allow him to expel every last Jew from the city forthwith. Hitler still had a geographical solution in mind, however. While agreeing with Goebbels that it would be counterproductive to settle this troublesome people, the Jews, in a harsh and character-building region like Siberia, he indicated a preference for settling them somewhere in Central Africa. Quote, "There, they'll be living in a climate which definitely won't make them tough and resilient. At any rate," end quote. And then, that's a funny quote. That's great. He's very, very attuned to the ease of living in a climate where you don't have to prepare for winter. Anyways, quote, "At any rate," recorded Goebbels with something of a shrug, "it's the Führer's aim to rid Western Europe of the Jews entirely," end quote. It is hard to reconcile such passages, dictated as the summer of 1942 approached, with the now fashionable belief that his chief had ordered an extermination program. As Hitler's train bore him back to East Prussia on May 30th, after speaking to officer candidates in Berlin, alarming reports reached him of a British air raid on Cologne. The local Gauleiter reported that the damage was vast. Goering insisted that only 70 or 80 planes had attacked the city, but Churchill announced that 1,000 bombers had taken part. Even Churchill, reasoned Hitler, could hardly get away with a tenfold exaggeration. He was prepared to accept that the RAF had sent over perhaps 300, no doubt as a sop to the Kremlin. When General Jeschenik insisted on the Luftwaffe's less credible version, Hitler retorted, quote, "I have never yet capitulated to an unpalatable truth, but I must see straight. if I am to draw the right conclusions, unquote. Goering made no secret of the Luftwaffe's inability to exact retribution. The people of Europe were now breathing a new climate of brutality.
Yep.
Hitler's contribution to this new climate was the forcible eviction of the Jews from Europe. He felt that in time, all Europe would understand his hatred. Quote, somehow, reasoned Goebbels too, we must eliminate them if they are not to eliminate us, end quote. And quite reasonable. The precise mode of elimination met with varying interpretations. Hitler's was unquestionably the authority behind the expulsion operations, but on precisely whose initiative the grim procedures at the terminal stations of this human exodus were adopted is arguable. Goebbels never lost an opportunity of keeping Hitler in line. Visiting the Wolf's Lair on January 19th, he had touched again on the Jewish problem, and noted afterwards, quote, on this the Führer holds without qualification to the existing and proper hardline views, unquote. This is hardly evidence of any initiative coming from Hitler. A few days later, the expulsions from Berlin actually halted for several months. What is known for certain is that at an interministerial conference on the logistics of solving the Jewish problem, which is held in Berlin's Wannsee suburb on the following day, January 20th, 1942, Himmler's Lieutenant Reinhard Heydrich briefed government officials thus. The Führer had sanctioned the evacuation of all Jews to eastern territories, substituting this for the overseas deportation originally planned, that is, Madagascar. In the east, the Jews would build roads until they dropped. This, and no more, is all that the much-mentioned Wannsee Conference protocols reveal. There was no talk of murder. Himmler's handwritten notes show that Heydrich phoned him the next day about the discussion. Jewish problem session in Berlin, quote-unquote. After telephoning Heydrich from the Wolf's Lair 4 days later, the Reichsfuhrer noted, quote, Jews into the KZs, unquote, the concentration camps. On the 27th and 28th, he again phoned Heydrich about arresting Jews. Over these few days, Himmler was often a guest at Hitler's table. For instance, on January 25th, when, according to Heinrich Heim's record, Hitler reflected out loud, quote, if I extract the Jew today, our citizens get uneasy. What's happening to him then? Oh. There's another quote within the quote here. What's happening to him then? Unquote. Did these same people care one hoot about what happened to the Germans who had to immigrate? We've got to get it over fast. It's no better to pull a tooth a bit at a time over 3 months. Once it's out, the agony is over. The Jews got to get out of Europe. Otherwise, we'll never reach a European consensus. He's the worst troublemaker everywhere. And really, am I not in fact terrifically humane? During the papal tyranny in Rome, the Jews were maltreated. Up to 1,830, they hounded 8 Jews. Oh, up to... That's not a number, it's a date. Up to 1830, they hounded 8 Jews through the city on asses every year. Yea, all I say is, he's got to get out. If he goes for a Burton in the process, I can't help it. I do see one thing, however. Their absolute elimination, if they won't leave willingly. Yep. End quote. Given his table company, Himmler himself, Lammers, and Colonel Hans Zietzler on this occasion, this was surely a significant private discourse by the Führer. On January 27th, he repeated the same arguments over dinner to a different audience. Quote, the Jew has got to get out of Europe. Best thing would be for them to go to Russia. I've no sympathy with the Jews. End quote. 3 days later, speaking in the Berlin Sportpalast, he reminded his audience of his prophetic warning to the world's Jews in 1939. Quote, the Führer, dictated Goebbels after lunching with him on February 17th, once again expresses his ruthless resolve to make a clean sweep of the Jews out of Europe. End quote. The only hint at uglier methods being employed might be read into Goebbels' diary claim that Hitler recognized in this context, quote, the major prospects opened up by war in all their significance, end quote. In a paper circulated early in March 1942, evidently the report on the conference at Wannsee, Heydrich's office advised the ministries that Europe's 11 million Jews were to be concentrated in the East for the time being. After the war, they might be allocated to a remote territory like Madagascar as a national home. At the same time, on March 6th, Heydrich held a second interministerial conference to examine the awkward problem posed by half and a quarter Jews. If allowed to remain, they might perhaps be sterilized. They're talking about genetic, you know, half and a quarter genetically Jewish. If allowed to remain, they might perhaps be sterilized. A top-level opinion, i.e. Hitler's, was quoted to the effect that they must draw a clear distinction between Jews and non-Jews, as it would not be acceptable for a mini-race of semi-Jews to be perpetuated in law. But this classification process would call for a colossal administrative effort, so the idea was shelved. Besides, even the lawyers did not like what underlay it. On March 12th, Dr. Franz Schegelberger of the Reich Justice Ministry wrote in some alarm to Dr. Hans Lammers, head of the Reich Chancellery, commenting on what he had learned of the recent conference. Quote, decisions seem to be afoot, he wrote, which I have to consider for the most part quite untenable, end quote. Stressing the need to brief the Führer in good time, meaning if the worst was to be prevented, he proposed they meet urgently. Lammers replied on the 18th that he would be in Berlin at the end of March. A subsequent aide memoir on Schegelberger's file, circulated among his top ministerial officials, reads in full, quote, Mr. Reich Minister Lammers informed me that the Führer has repeatedly declared to him that he wants to hear the solution of the Jewish problem, as he wants to hear that the solution of the Jewish problem has been postponed until after the war is over. That being so, the current discussions are of purely theoretical value, in Mr. Reich Minister Lammers' opinion. He will, moreover, take pains to ensure that whatever else happens, no fundamental decisions are taken without his knowledge in consequence of a surprise briefing of Hitler by any third party. End quote. Dr. Goebbels, agitating from Berlin, Dr. Goebbels, agitating from Berlin, clearly hoped for a more speedy and ruthless solution, although he held his tongue when meeting his Führer. On March 19th, he dictated for his diary only this remark by Hitler, quote, The Jews must get out of Europe. If need be, we must resort to the most brutal methods, end quote. That Goebbels privately knew somewhat more is plain from his diary entry on the 27th, quote, Beginning with Lublin, he recorded, the Jews are now being deported eastward from the general government. The procedure is pretty barbaric, and one that beggars description, and there's not much left of the Jews. By and large, he speculated, one can probably say that 60% of them will have to be liquidated, while only 40% can be put to work, end quote. Dr. Goebbels recorded further that the Trieste-born SS Brigadefuhrer Odilo Glubochnik, the former Gauleiter of Vienna, who was now the SS and police chief of the Lublin district, was performing this task carefully and unobtrusively. As fast as the ghettos of the general government were being emptied, they were being refilled with the Jews deported from the Reich, and the cycle started over again. Quote, The Jews have nothing to laugh about now, commented Goebbels. But there is no evidence that he discussed these realities with Hitler. Thus, this two-faced minister dictated after a further visit to Hitler on April 26th, quote, I have once again talked over the Jewish question with the Führer. His position on this problem is merciless. He wants to force the Jews right out of Europe. At this moment, Himmler is handling the major transfer of Jews from the German cities into the eastern ghettos, end quote. Not just from the cities of Germany, either. The Jews were being rounded up in France, Holland, Belgium, and the Nazi satellite Slovakia. From Hans Frank's general government, too, beginning with the ghettos of Lublin, the Jews were being shipped eastward under Glubochnik's direction. Upon arrival at their destinations further east, thousands were evidently simply being murdered. The available documents shed only oblique rays of light on the level of blame for this atrocity. at a general government cabinet meeting in Krakow on April 9, 1942, Hans Frank disclaimed responsibility. Quote, "It is obvious," he said, "that the work process will be disrupted if, in the midst of this labor program, the order comes to turn over all Jews for liquidation." The directive, he explained, comes from higher up. And there's an asterisk, and that's the end of the quote. Asterisk reads, "The semantics are significant." Hans Frank said, "from higher up, von Hörerstelle," where the allusion to Hitler, Nazi usage without exception preferred von Hochsterstelle, i.e. the top level, which occurs in a previous paragraph, or even von aller Hochsterstelle, whatever. So, doesn't sound like he's talking about Hitler. From a letter signed by SS Oberfuhrer Victor Brock to Himmler on June 23rd, it becomes clear that Himmler was anxious to conceal the operation, because he quoted Gloeckner as being eager to get it all over as quickly as possible, in case one day force majeure should prevent them from completing it. Quote, "You yourself, Reichsfuhrer, once mentioned that you felt the job would be done as quickly as possible, or should be done as quickly as possible, as if only for reasons of concealment." Let me read that one more time so I get it smoothly. "You yourself, Reichsfuhrer, once mentioned that you felt the job should be done as quickly as possible, if only for reasons of concealment." End quote. The gulf between the actual atrocities in the East and what Hitler knew or said about them widened. Over lunch on May 15th, he again merely spoke to his staff about transporting the Jews eastward. He referred indignantly to the misplaced sympathies of the bourgeoisie. How well the Jews were faring, he remarked, compared with the German immigrants of the 19th century, many of whom even died en route to Australia. Goebbels, unhappy that 40,000 Jews still remained in his Berlin, raised the subject at lunch with Hitler on the 29th. Quote, "I once again inform the Führer on my plan to evacuate every single Jew from Berlin," end quote. In response, Hitler merely expatiated on the best post-war homeland for the Jews. Siberia was out. That would just produce an even tougher strain of Jewish bacillus. Palestine was out, too. The Arabs did not want them. Perhaps Central Africa. At any rate, he summed up, Western Europe must be liberated of its Jews. There could be no homeland for them there. As late as July 24th, 1942, Hitler was still referring at table to his plan to transport the Jews to Madagascar, by now already in British hands, or some other Jewish national home after the war was over. Himmler kept his own counsels. From his papers, it emerges that on July 9th, his SS police chiefs Kruger, East, and Gloeckner, Lublin, orally briefed him on the solution of the Jewish problem. On the 16th, he visited Hitler. Photos in the modern Polish archives show Himmler visiting the immense synthetic rubber plant being erected by slave labor at Auschwitz on the 17th, and touring the concentration camp itself on the 18th in the company of his chief engineer SS Gruppenführer Hans Kammler and Fritz Bracht, the Gauleiter of Upper Silesia. The first trainload of Jews bound for Auschwitz had left Berlin on the 11th. In the insanitary conditions prevailing at the camp, an epidemic of typhus was now killing hundreds of prisoners every day, but still the transports rolled in through the gates. On September 4th, in reply to a request for 1,000 prisoners for construction work on the Danube Railway, Auschwitz informed Berlin that they could not provide them until the ban on the camp, Lagersperre, had been lifted. It was an odd one-way kind of quarantine. It appears that although typhus is still rife at Auschwitz, pointed out the British codebreakers who immediately deciphered this SS document, new arrivals continue to come in. End quote. Whatever later tribunals would claim, Hitler himself never visited any concentration camp, let alone Auschwitz. Nor, for that matter, did he ever visit a bombed city. Scholars have also claimed that Himmler witnessed the liquidation of a trainload of Jews on the occasion of his visit. This is devoid of any documentary substance. Under British post-war interrogation, Brock's 34 34-year-old deputy Albert Hoffman would recall this day and describe how he accompanied Himmler around Auschwitz. Conditions were, he volunteered, considerably worse than those he had seen at Dachau camp in 1938. Maltreatment did occur, noted his British post-war interrogator, and he has actually seen the crematorium ovens where bodies were being burned, end quote. But the interrogation report added, quote, he totally disbelieves the accounts of atrocities as published in the press, end quote. On July 19th, Himmler wrote this order to Kruger, quote, the transfer of the entire Jewish population of the general government is to be carried out and completed by December 31st, 1942, end quote. Hitler might be dreaming of Madagascar. His men were disposing differently. The Eastern Railroad at Krakow reported, quote, since July 22nd, one trainload of 5,000 Jews has been running away has been running from Warsaw via Malkinia to Treblinka every day. And in addition, a trainload of 5,000 Jews leaves Przemysl twice a week for Belzec, end quote. The transport ministry passed these data on to Karl Wolff, Himmler's chief of staff, with the postscript, quote, Globachnik has been told, end quote. Wolff thanked the ministry in fulsome terms for this information, namely, quote, that 14 days now one that for 14 days now one trainload a day of 5,000 members of the chosen people is going to Treblinka, end quote. On July 28th, Himmler issued this gentle rebuke to his chief aide, SS Gruppenführer Gottlob Berger, quote, the occupied eastern territories are to be liberated of Jews. The Führer himself has entrusted me with the execution of this arduous order. Nobody can deprive me of this responsibility, end quote. In August 1942, the Germans made the first approach to Hungary about deporting her 1 million Jews. Dome Stoje, Hungarian envoy in Berlin, reported this as a radical departure from Hitler's previous ruling that Hungary's Jewish problem could be left until the war, till after the war. Quote, the Germans, Count Stoje reported, are determined to rid Europe of the Jewish elements without further delay, and intend, regardless of nationality of these Jews, and provided that the transport facilities exist, to deport them to the occupied territories in the east, where they will be settled in ghettos or labor camps and put to work. According to absolutely reliable information, Reichsfuhrer Himmler has informed a meeting of SS leaders that the general government, or no, not the general government, the German government desires to complete the deportations within a year, end quote. Himmler continued to deceive his Führer. On September 17th, he calmly noted for that day's conference, quote, one, Jewish emigration, Auswanderung. How is it to be handled in our future? Two, settlement of Lublin, quote, end quote. And as a result of these points, quote, conditions in general government and Globus, Globachnik's name, I'm reading that wrong. Maybe his quote is still going. Himmler continued to deceive his Führer. September 17th, he calmly noted for that day's conference, Jewish immigration, how is it to be handled in the future, settlement of Lublin, and as a result of these points, conditions in general government and Globus, Globachnik's name. Goebbels spoke 6 days later in more unmistakable terms to 60 government journalists. I guess that was the end quote. Pleading for greater security consciousness, he pointed out that there were still 48,000 Jews in Berlin. Quote, they know with a deadly certainty, he said, that in the course of this war, they will be deported to the East and left to their murderous fate, end quote. These Jews, he added, could already sense the inexorable tread of physical annihilation, end quote. And this was why they were inflicting as much damage on Hitler's Reich as they could, so long as they live. There's a bunch of little quotes in there, so it's throwing me off. And that's the end of the chapter.